Final snap of the ball game. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, underdogs at home.
And it's now official. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers have won Super Bowl 55. The first time they've won the Super Bowl for 18 years.
Señoras y señores, campeón del Super Bowl número 55, Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Tom Brady takes a knee, and it's a rise, Sir Tom. It's a feat that will echo across sport for eternity.
He is risen. Sir Tom and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are Super Bowl champions in a shockingly decisive victory over the theoretically unstoppable Kansas City Chiefs. Bill Barnwell breaks down what went wrong for quarterback Patrick Mahomes and what got Tom Brady his seventh and most unexpected ring. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, February 8th. This is ESPN Daily. Three, two, one. Bill, it is 11:29 p.m. Eastern, and we made it. We have arrived at our final late Sunday night session of the NFL season.
I think you're showing the appropriate level of enthusiasm for the game we just watched.
Bill Barnwell has been our NFL oracle through lo these many football weeks. You can catch his wisdom on the Bill Barnwell Show podcast and his Monday column on ESPN Plus. Bill, I know I'm washed. I knew that coming in, but tonight I also discovered that I'm like had to close my eyes because the weekend's halftime show is making me dizzy. Washed. So on top of the soporific Super Bowl we ended up getting, I'm also just the opposite of Tom Brady in every sort of genetic sense, it turns out.
There were so many songs I've heard in Ubers or at bodegas before. But I was like, oh, that's who does that song. That song's I'm okay with that song. So that I really learned a lot during the halftime show. Not sure I learned so much during the actual game itself. I mean, it just in thinking about what our most notable takeaway or the moment we remember from the Super Bowl will be years from now, it comes down to maybe Mecole Hardman lining up a full yard offsides on a field goal try. Tony Romo getting very excited about a streaker in the fourth quarter of a blowout, where he was trying to will the game to be competitive. This was a complete and utter dominant victory by the Buccaneers, and it was an upset, but the thoroughness of the whole thing and the repetitive nature of what happened from series and series, from possession to possession, really just sort of, by the end of the game, everyone knew what the story was because it was really obvious.
So it did feel at times, Bill, like we were getting Tom Brady playing his hits. But before we pay our respects at the altar of Brady and all of his non-washedness, I want to ask how exactly Kansas City and Patrick Mahomes looked this helpless? Because that's what was shocking to me. You have to go back to 2017 before Mahomes was a starter in the league to find a game where the Chiefs had been shut out of the end zone entirely before tonight. So how did the Buccaneers, how did defensive coordinator Todd Bowles stop one of the most unstoppable offenses we had ever seen?
It was, you know, sort of a game plan out of the 1960s. It was winning at the line of scrimmage and dominating up front. And, you know, I don't want to exaggerate. I don't want to subscribe to recency bias. But I have to admit, I'm not sure I've ever seen an offensive line get beaten as badly over the course of an entire game as the Chiefs were by the Buccaneers on Sunday night. I mean, last year in the Super Bowl, we saw Nick Bosa and the 49ers really dominate the Chiefs for most of the first three quarters, and we're on pace to win that game. But fourth quarter, Nick Bosa and the Niners got tired, and Patrick Mahomes turned things around very quickly. The Chiefs launched forward, scored a bunch of touchdowns, and won the Super Bowl. And this time around, we were sort of waiting for that moment, right? And it never happens. The Buccaneers pressure Mahomes on virtually every single meaningful pass play of this game, often immediately.
KC moving left, here's the snap on third. Mahomes pressured, he throws the ball away. There's nobody in the area. Was he out of the tackle box? Mr. Ref, is that intentional grounding? Big time pressure by Shaq Barrett.
Very rarely was it Mahomes just holding onto the football and running himself into pressures. It was constant from the snap pressure across the board. Todd Bowles did a great job of creating one-on-one matchups by overloading sides of the line And what that did was isolate the Chiefs offensive linemen into one-on-one matchups. It really didn't matter which offensive lineman it was or which defensive lineman it was. Really, any combination of the two, the Bucs were winning. They went over and over and over again. And Bowles had other wrinkles. He would line up Shaq Barrett and Ndamukong Suh next to each other, both outside the tight end as wide nine rushers, or use 350-pound tackle Vita Vea as a defensive end to get his actual defensive ends on the inside with easier paths to the quarterback against Kansas City's guards. It honestly, more than anything, reminded me of what Steve Spagnuolo's Giants did to Tom Brady's Patriots in the 18-0 Super Bowl back in 2007. Now, the roles were reversed, and Brady was the one who was benefiting from a dominant defensive line.
And all of that pressure from that defensive line, I mean, it mostly resulted in Mahomes throwing some of the most incredible incompletions in NFL history. We saw him throwing sidearm parallel to the ground, running out of bounds, bouncing balls off his receiver's face masks, but he also threw two interceptions.
Third down and 13. Mahomes looking, under pressure, throws the ball upfield. It is knocked away at the 50-yard line.
Intercepted,
picked off a deflection. Bucks have the football. It's Antoine Winfield.
Yes. He is the best quarterback in the league in terms of creating something out of nothing, out of structure. And I think after this game, he should go into the Hall of Fame strictly for his incompletions. Nobody throws better incompletions than Patrick Mahomes. But
nobody.
But even given how good he is out of structure, the Buccaneers basically forced him to abandon the offense for most of this game. According to ESPN Stats and Info, and I stole this from our good friend Mita Kimes on Twitter, Mahomes was pressured on nearly 52% of his dropbacks. That's the highest rate for any quarterback in the history of the Super Bowl.
Wow.
He was only sacked three times.
Second down, Chiefs dropping to throw Mahomes. We run a stunt, and we sack him at the 50-yard line. Wow, he's clobbered, fumble the football, recovered by the Chiefs.
Because he made magic happen. His turf toe didn't help, of course. He was hobbling at times. He missed a couple checkdowns. But nobody would have been able to do anything against this sort of pressure. Mahomes did, by all accounts, given what he was facing in this game, an incredible job. Even the incompletions, the stuff he was doing to get away from pass rushers to extend plays, was incredible. And because the Bucs were able to get so much pressure with four, even when Mahomes did get away from the pressure, Bowles didn't have to blitz. Tampa spent virtually all of this game with two deep safeties to take away Tyreek Hill and that deep passing attack after playing with only one safety in the middle of the field during that disastrous run in the first half of the game in the regular season. Their linebackers, who were picked apart on RPOs in Week 12, did a great job of slowing down Travis Kelce while the game was close. Bowles might have had a plan B or a plan C if the Chiefs were able to get past this four-man rush and the two deep safeties, but plan A was so successful that he didn't need anything else.
It was amazing to watch plan A unfold, Bill. And I want to understand better how much the utter porousness of that offensive line of Kansas City enabled that degree of success. Because coming into this game, we did know that the Chiefs were dealing with like this staggering amount of turnover on the O-line. They're rotating bodies around like this triage unit. But our assumption was that Kansas City's ability to score to come back from virtually any deficit, that all of that stuff was basically going to render that moot.
Yeah, it felt like Mahomes was always going to have an answer, that he was his own best pass protector. But in this game, the Chiefs finally felt the impact of losing so many offensive linemen. I mean, it was just an unrecognizable line, in part because we don't know the names, but in part because they spent most of the game either buried in the turf or chasing the pass rushers who had gotten past them and were running towards Mahomes. Great offenses like the Chiefs, yeah, they can overcome missing one lineman or even two linemen. There was just nowhere for the Chiefs to hide, nothing for them to depend upon. And there was nothing they really had in their arsenal that seemed to work. The screens and short throws they might use to counteract those pressures were sloppy. They didn't succeed. And Mahomes just spent most of the game running for his life. So even if Andy Reid had something drawn up, by the time Patrick Mahomes actually got the snap, it was over.
And Chiefs fans, as it happens, Bill, they spend most of the game complaining about all of the penalty flags. And look, the penalties did seem to tilt in aggregate, mostly against Kansas City, I suppose. So I just want your analytical vantage point here, detached from social media influence. What did you see?
Yes, as someone who, during the recording of this podcast, has now gone 5 minutes without checking Twitter, I qualify as detached social media presence.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge outcry about the penalties around halftime because we had just seen back-to-back big calls against the Chiefs, a pair of pass interference penalties. I have to admit, Pablo, I don't think the Chiefs were subject to many terrible calls in this game. Some of the penalties we saw were obviously calls. There was an incredible holding penalty on a punt where a guy was grabbed with both hands and flung around. The definition of a holding penalty. Mecole Hardman, like I said, lined up seemingly a full yard off sides on a field goal try. Chris Jones smacked Ryan Jensen.
Unnecessary roughness, number 95, defense, 15 yards will be added to the end of the play.
Chris Jones.
A personal foul, which was so obvious in advance that Jeff Schwartz called it on my podcast 3 days before the game started.
Ryan and Chris Jones are going to fight. I don't know when it's going to happen. I'm going to guess like probably end of first half is when they're going to just like start throwing fists at each other.
The long pass interference penalty that came in for some criticism that was drawn by Mike Evans before the half was a legit call. Rashad Breeland got his feet tangled with Evans, which is not a penalty, but then dragged him down as he fell, which was a penalty. Yeah, you could maybe make a case that Tyrann Mathieu shouldn't have been flagged for pass interference late in the first half, or that the refs were wrong to call a holding penalty, which ended up wiping away a Brady interception also in the first half. But overall, I don't think the issue is that the majority of the calls in this game were wrong or biased towards one team. The bigger issue is that the refs called anything at all. This is a season where we talked about this on the podcast, Pablo. Calls, and honestly, particularly defensive holding, have been down across the board. The refs basically forgot to whistle anything in the first 58 minutes of the NFC Championship game, to the point where there was a play where Kevin King pulled a receiver's jersey like it was string cheese. And a lot of people were genuinely mad that it was called. In the Super Bowl, the refs routinely let the players get more physical and, yes, hold without steady flags. We've seen the calls in the Super Bowl go down in years past. Instead, we got a Super Bowl which was refereed like a regular season game from the past 5 years. In the long run, given how dominant the Bucs were from start to finish, I think anyone complaining that the referees won this game for Tom Brady and Tampa Bay is trying too hard to avoid what happened on every single Chiefs snap on offense, which was utter and total domination from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
All right, Bill, up next, I want to get finally to Thomas Edward Patrick Brady, who lived up to every single one of his names. And I want to ask where he and the NFL, where they go from here.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So the Super Bowl is this occasion, Bill, for familiar combinations. We got chips and dip. I myself am a big buffalo wings and white rice guy. And on Sunday, we got Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski. And I'm trying to remember here, Bill, what was Gronk even doing around this time last year?
Believe he was selling CBD.
Yes, that's right.
He was not doing a cruise. Surprisingly, that was during his career, not afterwards. But I believe he was about to become a WWE wrestler in advance of WrestleMania, which was several months later.
It's Rob Gronkowski's up on the perch.
Don't do it, Gronk!
Oh, my God! Gronk took out everyone!
Of course he was. So fast forward 1 year, and here we have Rob Gronkowski being Rob Gronkowski. And by that, I mean being an instrumental part of an offense led by Tom Brady to win a Super Bowl. So what happened in this game tonight? Because Gronk wasn't this enormous part of the offense in the regular season.
Yes. And we saw this during the last Patriots Super Bowl season too. That was the year where Gronk was injured. There was pretty much constant talk about him retiring. But when Tom Brady needed Gronk in key moments, like when they beat the Chiefs in the postseason, Rob Gronkowski showed up with big plays. Go to the Super Bowl that year against the Rams. They are doing nothing on offense until they run the same pass concept, Haas-Wide-Juke, on three straight plays to set up the only touchdown of the game. And they were able to run that because Rob Gronkowski, at that time, was essentially two players in one. He was a receiver who could threaten teams vertically and a blocker who can handle 300-pound defensive ends one-on-one. Tight ends don't do those things, let alone both those things. He was both of those guys in that game, and he was both of them again on Sunday. He did it all game for the Buccaneers. He moved all over the field and won everywhere. He caught one touchdown pass as an inline tight end moving across the formation on a pick play against the safety. He caught a second touchdown running deep and just shaking a really talented slot corner in rookie Legarius Sneed. And Gronk was a force as a blocker on the edge, sealing off defensive ends as Leonard Fournette and Ronald Jones broke run after run off tackle for big gains. Rob Gronkowski is the best tight end of all time. He hasn't been that guy every single week this year. I mean, you can remember going back to September when Bruce Arians was saying he was there to be a blocker. But when Tom Brady needed him, Rob Gronkowski showed up when it mattered most, and that was the Super Bowl.
KC 8, here's the snap out of the gun. Play action fake, pass to Gronkowski. He's going to score a touchdown. Touchdown, Tampa Bay. Holy Gronkaboli. He breaks the record. He's got his 23rd touchdown in the postseason from Tom Brady.
I cannot wait for Gronk to give his Hall of Fame speech, by the way. He's going to he's going to suplex someone onto the podium. But in the meantime, it is worth reiterating, Bill, that Tom Brady is always that guy when it matters himself. Mm-hmm. And look, he was a startling, an almost startlingly comfortable 21 of 29 for three touchdowns to win, yes, his seventh Super Bowl in 10 tries. Yes. So how did he find himself living what seemed to be the complete opposite of what his far younger rival, Patrick Mahomes, was experiencing tonight?
Yes. I mean, just as Mahomes spent the entire game frantically running around, desperately trying to avoid Bucks who were coming from all angles, Tom Brady took out a chair. He posted up in the pocket. He was very comfortable and just scanned around, saw what was available. And usually it was an open receiver. The Chiefs sent a cover zero blitz early in this game on third down to force a punt. And I kind of thought, okay, well, this is what the game plan is going to be. Tom Brady's going to get blitzed a ton in key situations, but they never seemed to get ahead of Brady and ahead of Bruce Arians and Byron Leftwich again, per ESPN Stats and Info, and again, per our friend Mina Kimes. Brady was pressured on just 13.3% of his dropbacks. That's way below the rate the first time these two teams played, which was 23.8%. The Bucs used way more play action this time, a Brady favorite going back to his time with New England. And hey, what do you know? Tom Brady was 10 of 13 for 135 yards and three touchdowns with play action in this game. We also saw the Bucs manipulate the Chiefs personnel on defense by creating mismatches with their offensive personnel. Now, Gronk is himself a mismatch, but let me introduce the guy who dropped a touchdown in the end zone, sadly, offensive lineman Joe Haig. Because outside of that, Joe Haig was great in this game. He was on the field a bunch as a sixth offensive lineman. And what that did was force the Chiefs to get into one of two situations that didn't work. The Chiefs are typically a five defensive back and six defensive back nickel and dime defense. If you want to play that against a six offensive lineman set, you're going to get your safeties and cornerbacks run over by a guy who weighs 100 pounds or more than them in Joe Haig. Instead, what the Chiefs did was try and match with their base defense, and that gets linebackers and safeties onto the field who Brady can exploit in the passing game. The game plan was to target those safeties and target the linebackers. And the other factor on top of all that is that the Bucs helped keep Brady out of third and long by succeeding on early downs with their running attack. Brady's average third down came with 4 yards to go before his game-ending kneel down. Patrick Mahomes' average third down came with nearly 9 yards to go, including a third and 33, if I'm not mistaken, at some point during this game. He failed to complete a single third down pass until there were 6 minutes left to go in the fourth quarter. Third and long is an obvious pressure down, but the Chiefs weren't ever able to get there.
So given all this, Bill, is there anything left to say about Tom Brady that hasn't already been said and or rubbed into our faces at this point?
Oh, boy. Here's what I would say. When I think about this year, this was such a strange season for so many reasons. It really seemed to favor the teams who kept their veteran quarterbacks in the same place. Teams like the Packers, for example, had great seasons. This is a year where so many quarterbacks went in directions we couldn't have expected. Josh Allen went from being a question mark to being an MVP candidate. Jared Goff went from being a Super Bowl caliber quarterback to a guy the Rams could not wait to get rid of. So many quarterbacks went in so many directions this year, and yet Tom Brady changed teams, didn't get a full offseason, and somehow seemed to be, if not exactly the same, maybe even better than the guy we saw in his final season in New England. That shouldn't happen, you know, for a guy changing teams, let alone a guy who's 43 years old, and yet here we are.
So let's look ahead now, Bill, ahead to next season. What should we be expecting from that particular sort of human being in Tom Brady on this defending Super Bowl champion team?
The Bucs are not going anywhere. Think about what's happening around them right now. Drew Brees appears to be retiring, and the Saints, who won the NFC South this year, are still more than $50 million over the salary cap. Aaron Rodgers was incredible this year, but he's probably not going to win league MVP again. The Rams are going to try and ride six players and 47 guys you've never heard of to a Super Bowl. The NFC East is still the NFC East. If anything, the path to a Super Bowl next year might be easier for the Bucs than it was this season. They return most of their core. They'll have to try and find a way to bring back free agents like Ndamukong Suh, Shaq Barrett, and Chris Godwin. But after winning a Super Bowl, those guys are going to have every motivation to come back. Gronk and Antonio Brown, who also scored a touchdown in this game, are both free agents. But you have to figure they're going to take another discount to keep playing with Brady. If you can win a Super Bowl, win it in Florida with no income tax, and do it with Tom Brady before he retires, that's going to be a very appealing destination to a lot of free agents.
So I guess that's it, Bill. Is that it? The NFL season is over now. What do we do with ourselves?
Well, we wait 2 days, and then we talk about Carson Wentz getting traded. So that appears to be what's going to happen next year.
Yes.
Yeah, sometime through the third quarter, when it was clear what was going to happen in this game, I think I started thinking more about the Carson Wentz situation. And it felt like that trade might overshadow the Super Bowl heading into this game. It felt like the Eagles were putting those feelers out there to try and get a Matthew Stafford-sized deal done for their deposed quarterback before the Super Bowl began. It felt like they were admitting they reached the point of no return, that despite firing Doug Peterson, in part to save Wentz with the team, that he just doesn't want to come back. And the Eagles don't want to be stuck with that contract on their books for two more seasons, which is essentially what is going to happen if they don't trade Wentz before the new league year starts in March. When it looked like they were only going to get a mid-round pick for Wentz, I don't think they were really as inclined to make a move and trade Wentz away. But the possibility of getting two first-round picks for Wentz, like the Lions did with Stafford, that changes things. Nobody hit that point over the weekend, but think about it. This is a market where the Patriots, Colts, Texans, Broncos, Bears, Panthers, 49ers, and Washington could all be in the market for Wentz.
So if you're going to handicap the contenders, Bill, for Wentz in this next week of chaos, what does that picture look like?
If there is a team that is going to go into a panic and go over the top to make an offer for Wentz, I have to look forward to the Chicago Bears. Because they are the most desperate team of this bunch. They have no quarterback. Mitch Trubisky is a free agent. They bench Nick Foles during the regular season. And Matt Nagy and Ryan Pace, their coach and GM, are probably going to get fired if they don't find a quarterback solution by the end of 2021. They don't have the sort of high draft pick you would need to take a quarterback in the first round, and they don't have a lot of cap space, so they really can't go out after a free agent. They can justify a Wentz trade by pointing to the presence of John DeFilippo, who was the quarterback's coach in Philadelphia when Carson Wentz had his big year. And after the Foles trade, we know how important it is for them to find someone who quote-unquote knows the scheme. They can also send Foles back to the Eagles as part of the deal, which should cure at least some of the anger in Philadelphia. Of course, if the Eagles can get two first-round picks for Wentz, we're going to hear about other teams who look at their quarterback and might eye those two first-round picks with some desire. The first rumors began to pop up this week about the Raiders possibly shopping Derek Carr. The Lions could still deal Jared Goff for picks. The Deshaun Watson deal still hasn't happened and doesn't appear to be any closer to any sort of resolution. The 2020 season is officially over. Pablo, by around the halfway point of the third quarter, it felt like the league was already on to 2021.
Bill Barnwell, I'm going to miss these late Sunday nights with you. I feel like we should also be kind of exchanging and signing yearbooks at this point in the podcast.
Yeah, I am going to be the person who is most likely to come back on the podcast in 3 days to talk about the Carson Wentz trade.
I will see you far sooner than you deserve.
Thank you, Papa.
Up next, a tribute to a should-be basketball Hall of Famer who is the last of his kind.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. The most important evaluator of teenage basketball players in America is a guy named Tom Konchalski, the author of a small typewritten newsletter called High School Basketball Illustrated. Coach K subscribed, as did John Calipari and Bob Knight and Rick Pitino, and over more than 50 years, pretty much every college coach that matters. The coaches all marveled at Konchalski's encyclopedic brain and his photographic memory and his eye for talent. Back in 1980, while working at the 5-star basketball camp, Konchalski was the very first person to tag a young Mike Jordan for greatness. But now, more than ever, the coaches marvel at how Tom Konchalski is the last of his kind. In this era of Zoom calls and Substacks and perpetual remote connection, the scout hasn't just refused to own a cell phone, which the rest of us more or less grafted to our hands. Konchalski refused to have an answering machine and an email address and a computer. He honed his craft in person, artisanally, becoming known for his handwritten yellow legal pads and hand-charted stats and famously firm handshakes. His presence alone seemed to validate any building he entered. And then he'd return to the typewriter inside his queen's apartment, and he'd mail out each of his newsletters by hand. Tom Konchalski entered hospice care this weekend at age 74, now in the second year of his fight against metastatic cancer. 1 year after being forced to step away from those gyms and his typewriter for good. It has been remarkable to see the weight of tribute to him, not just from the coaches who were his subscribers, but from his actual focus for a half century. The players, the people he spent his life taking seriously, the teenagers whose hands he firmly shook, from Bernard King to Mike Jordan to Kevin Durant, Konchalski's photographic memory had traced and shaped so many career trajectories, where they came from, who they played with, where they'd go. And so the next stop in Konchalski's career trajectory should be obvious. The man is eligible this year for induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. And no, Konchalski never saw himself as anything close to a real player, let alone a Hall of Fame prospect. But his presence alone would validate the building. It always did. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.